13. Little Boat. Her seat on the upper deck of this British Airways 747 subsides into a bed that makes her think of a little boat, a coracle of Hexal and teak finish laminate. She's nearest the nose, no other seating units in her line of sight. The cabin is like some optimally comfy cube farm, a cluster of automated, supremely ergonomic workstation enclosures. It feels as though, with just a little more engineering, they could simultaneously tube-feed you and tidally exhaust the resulting wastes. However, many hours in the air now, her watch tucked ritually out of sight, dinner served, lights dimmed, she imagines her soul bobbing stupidly somewhere back over the concrete of Heathrow, its invisible tether spooling steadily out of her. As does a certain degree of fear, she notes, now that she knows they must be far out over an ocean where no human agents threaten. For most of her life, flying, she'd felt most vulnerable right here, suspended in a void above trackless water. But now her conscious flying fears are about things that might be arranged to happen over populous human settlements, fears of ground-to-air, of scripted CNN moments. But commercial aircraft have also been problematic for Case in another way, with their endless claustrophobic repetition of the carrier's logo. BA has never been particularly difficult, but Virgin, with its multi-pronged product associations, is completely impossible. Her biggest problem with BA now, she reminds herself, is a more ordinary one. No movies she'd ever consider watching in the armrest DVD. She's under a personally enforced video news ban in effect now for some time. She's neglected to bring anything to read, and sleep refuses to come. With London receding and Tokyo still largely unimagined, unremembered, she sits up cross-legged in the center of her narrow little bed and knuckles her eyes, feeling like a bedridden child, just well enough to be utterly restless. Then she remembers Big N's iBook with its bright new Heathrow security sticker. She hauls the nylon case up from the floor and opens it. She had spent 20 minutes the night before poking around on the desktop, but now for the first time she notices an unmarked CD-ROM that proves on insertion to be a searchable database of all of FFF. Whoever does these things for Big End has also provided on the hard drive a complete collection of the footage and her three favorite edits, one of them by Filmy and Maurice. Still sitting cross-legged, she makes a sticky, copy CD for Ivy. Ivy's wanted a searchable database of the forum almost since the forum began, because the free software that allows her to keep the site up isn't searchable, and she hasn't had anyone willing or able to do the compiling. Posters have bookmarked their favorite threads and swapped them, but there's been no way to trace a particular topic or theme through the site's evolution. Or rather, now there is. Case has no idea how many pages of posts have accumulated since the site's first day. She's never gone back and looked at that, at the UR site, the early days. But now she enters and searches, Case P. On the contrary, as I was saying yesterday... Ah, not her first post. At first she hadn't been called Case P. Re-enters Case. Hi, how many segments in all? Just downloaded the one where he's on the rooftop. Has anyone been able to do anything with those chimney pots? Is that what you call them? She'd added the P later because there had briefly been another Case, a surname, a Marvin in Wichita, who'd also pronounced it Case, not Casey. She feels somewhat the way she might have if she uncovered her high school yearbook. Here's Parker Boy's first post. Well, suck me raw with a breast pump. I thought I was the only one out here obsessing about the peculiar beauties of this particularly spotty stretch of anomalous cinematic prairie. Anybody into cowboy poetry as well? Because let me assure you, I'm not. This had been prior to Lion Arkea's arrival, after 3 days of which Parkaboy had made the first of his many noisy departures from the site. She fiddles with the matte alloy buttons on her armrest, converting her bed into a lounger. It feels good when it moves, powerful motors devoted to her comfort. She settles back in her black sweats, having declined the offer of a BA romper suit, and pulls the tartan blanket across her legs, iBook on her stomach, adjusts the snaky fiber-optic reading lamp with its head like a policeman's flashlight, exits the CD-ROM and clicks on Filmy and Maurice's edit. It opens on that rooftop against the oddly shaped chimneys. He is there, walks to the low parapet, looks out toward a city that never resolves. A frame grab on what he sees would reveal only a faint arrangement of vertical and horizontal lines. No focus. Definitely a skyline, but not enough information to provide any sort of identification. Rule out Manhattan. Others, there are lists arguing the places it cannot, might not be. Maurice cuts to that segment that consists entirely of long shots, the girl in the formal park. Sometimes, when she watches a good edit, and this is one of the best, it's as though it's all new. She sinks into it with joy and anticipation, and when the edit ends, she's shocked. That's it. All there is. How can that be? This is one of those times. It ends. She falls asleep, iBook on her lap. When she wakes, the cabin is darker, and she needs to pee. Grateful that she isn't wearing a BA romper, she shuts the iBook down, stows it away, unbuckles her seatbelt, puts on BA slippers, and makes her way back toward the toilets. Passing as she does, what can only be the sleeping form of Billy Pryan, snoring lightly, his still unparalyzed mouth slightly opened. He has his tartan blanket arranged around his shoulders like an old man in a bath chair, his face slack and inert. She blinks, trying to convince herself that this cannot be the former lead singer of BSE, but it quite clearly is, all in what looks to be last season's Agnes B. Home. In the coracle nearest Brian sleeps a blindfolded blonde, a pair of modest nipple rings clearly visible in outline through the taut black fabric of her top. This, Case decides, further confirming her identification of Brian, is the singer from the former Velcro Kitty, the one the music press had supposed he was no longer with. She forces herself to shuffle on in her navy vinyl slippers to the almost spacious safety of a first-class toilet, with its fresh flowers and molten brown face stuff, where she locks the door and sits, unable to put this together. Pryan, at whose gallery Wojtek hopes to show his ZX81 project, is on her flight to Tokyo. Why? If it's that small a world, it starts to smell funny. Watching that intensely blue fluid pressure swirl down as she flushes. Returning to her seat, she sees the nipple-ringed singer awake, seated upright, blindfold discarded, studying a glossy fashion magazine under a tightly focused fiber-optic beam. Pryan is still snoring. Back in her own little boat, she accepts a lukewarm white washcloth from the flight attendant's tongs. Why are they here on this flight, Pryan and the Velcro Kitty Girl? She remembers her father's view on paranoia. Wynne, the Cold War security expert, ever watchful, had treated paranoia as though it were something to be domesticated and trained. Like someone who'd learned how best to cope with chronic illness, he never allowed himself to think of his paranoia as an aspect of self. It was there, constantly and intimately, and he relied on it professionally, but he wouldn't allow it to spread, become jungle. He cultivated it on its own special plot and checked it daily for news it might bring. Hunches, lateralisms, frank anomalies. Is Pryan's presence on this plane a frank anomaly? Only, she decides, if she thinks of herself as the center, the focal point of something she doesn't, can't understand. That had always been Wynne's first line of defense within himself, to recognize that he was only a part of something larger. Paranoia, he said, was fundamentally egocentric, and every conspiracy theory served in some way to aggrandize the believer. But he was also fond of saying at other times that even paranoid schizophrenics have enemies. The danger, she supposes, is a species of apophania. The damp white cloth has grown cold in her hand. She places it on the armrest and closes her eyes.